This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents I'll Be Gone in the Dark, One Woman's Obsessive Search for the Golden State Killer by Michelle McNamara. Read by Gabber Zachman, with an introduction written and read by Gillian Flynn, and an afterword written and read by Patton Oswalt. This audiobook includes a PDF enhancement containing a timeline map, a breakdown of the victims and investigators, and figures referenced in the audiobook. Please download the PDF from your audiobook provider.
Introduction. Before the Golden State Killer, there was the girl. Michelle will tell you about her. The girl dragged into the alley off Pleasant Street, murdered and left like so much trash. The girl, a young 20-something, was killed in 1984 in Oak Park, Illinois, a few blocks from where Michelle grew up in a busy Irish Catholic home. Michelle, the youngest child of six kids, signed her diary entries, Michelle, the writer. She said the murder ignited her interest in true crime. We would have made a good, if perhaps strange, pair at the same time in the mid-80s in my young teens, back in Kansas City, Missouri. I, too, was an aspiring writer, although I gave myself a slightly loftier moniker in my journal, Gillian the Great. Like Michelle, I grew up in a big Irish family, went to Catholic school, nurtured a fascination with the dark. I read Truman Capote's In Cold Blood at age 12, a cheap secondhand purchase, and this would launch my lifelong obsession with true crime. I love reading true crime, but I've always been aware of the fact that, as a reader, I am actively choosing to be a consumer of someone else's tragedy. So like any responsible consumer, I try to be very careful in the choices I make. I read only the best, writers who are dogged, insightful, and humane. It was inevitable that I would find Michelle. I've always thought the least appreciated aspect of a great true crime writer is humanity. Michelle McNamara had an uncanny ability to get into the minds of not just killers, but the cops who hunted them, the victims they destroyed, and the trail of grieving relatives left behind. As an adult, I became a regular visitor of her remarkable blog, True Crime Diary. "You should drop her a line," my husband would urge. She was from Chicago. I live in Chicago. Both of us were moms who spent unwholesome amounts of time looking under rocks at the dark sides of humanity. I resisted my husband's urging. I think the closest I came to meeting Michelle was introducing myself to an aunt of hers at a book event. She loaned me her phone, and I texted Michelle something notably unauthorly like, "You are the coolest!" 3 exclamation marks. The truth was, I was unsure whether I wanted to meet this writer. I felt outmatched by her. I create characters. She had to deal with facts, go where the story took her. She had to earn the trust of wary, weary investigators, brave the mountains of paperwork that may contain that one crucial piece of information, and convince devastated family and friends to needle around in old wounds. She did all this with a particular sort of grace, writing in the night as her family slept from a room strewn with her daughter's construction paper, scribbling down California penal codes in crayon. I'm a nasty collector of killers, but I wasn't aware of the man Michelle had dubbed the Golden State Killer until she started writing about this nightmare, who was responsible for 50 sexual assaults and at least 10 murders in California during the 1970s and 80s. This was a decades-old cold case. Witnesses and victims had moved away or passed away or moved on. The case encompassed multiple jurisdictions in both Southern and Northern California and involved myriad crime files that lacked the benefits of DNA or lab analysis. There were very few writers who would take this on, fewer still who would do it well. Michelle's doggedness in pursuing this case was astounding. In a typical instance, she tracked down a pair of cufflinks that had been stolen from a Stockton crime scene in 1977 on the website of a vintage store in Oregon. But she didn't do just this. She could also tell you that, quote, "boys' names beginning and end were relatively rare, appearing only once in the top 100 names of the 1930s and 40s, when the original owner of the cufflinks was likely born." Mind you, this isn't even a clue leading to the killer. It's a clue leading to the cufflinks that the killer stole. This dedication to particulars was typical, writes Michelle. I once spent an afternoon tracking down every detail I could about a member of the 1972 Rio Americano High School water polo team because in the yearbook photo he appeared lean and to have big calves, a possible physical trait of the Golden State Killer. Many writers who have sweat and bled gathering this much research can get lost in the details. Statistics and information tend to elbow out humanity. The traits that make one a painstaking researcher are often at odds with the nuance of life. But I'll be gone in the dark while a beautiful work of reporting is equally a snapshot of the time, place, and person. Michelle brings to life the California subdivisions that were edging out orange groves, the glassy new developments that made victims the stars of their own horrific thrillers, the towns that lived in the shadow of mountains that came alive once a year with thousands of scuttling tarantulas searching for mates. And the people. Good God, the people. Hopeful ex-hippies, striving newlyweds, a mother and her teen daughter arguing over freedom and responsibility and swimsuits for what they didn't realize would be the last time. I was hooked from the beginning, and so was Michelle, it seems. Her multi-year hunt for the identity of the Golden State Killer took a harsh toll on her. As she says, there's a scream permanently lodged in my throat now. Michelle passed away in her sleep at age 46 before she could finish this remarkable book. You'll find case notes from her colleagues, but the identity of the Golden State Killer, the whodunit, remains unresolved. His identity matters not a whit to me. I want him captured. I don't care who he is. Looking at such a man's face is anticlimactic, attaching a name even more so. We know what he did. Any information beyond that will inevitably feel pedestrian, pale, somehow cliche. My mother was cruel. I hate women. I never had a family. And so on. I want to know more about true, complete people, not dirty scraps of humans. I want to know more about Michelle. As she detailed her search for this shadowy man, I found myself looking for clues to this writer I so admire. Who was the woman whom I trusted enough to follow into this nightmare? What was she like? What made her this way? What gave her this grace? One summer day, I found myself driving the 20 minutes from my Chicago home out to Oak Park to the alley where the girl was found, where Michelle, the writer, discovered her calling. I didn't realize until I was there why I was there. It was because I was in my own search, hunting this remarkable hunter of darkness. Gillian Flynn.
No butler, no second maid, no blood upon the stair. No eccentric aunt, no gardener, no family friend, smiling among the bric-a-brac and murder. Only a suburban house with the front door open, and a dog barking at a squirrel, and the cars passing. The corpse quite dead. The wife in Florida. Consider the clues. The potato masher in a vase. The torn photograph of a Wesleyan basketball team, scattered with check stubs in the hall. The unsent fan letter to Shirley Temple. The Hoover button on the lapel of the deceased. The note, "To be killed this way is quite all right with me." Small wonder that the case remains unsolved, or that the sleuth, LaRue, is now incurably insane and sits alone in a white room in a white gown, screaming that all the world is mad, that clues lead nowhere or to walls so high their tops cannot be seen, screaming all day of war, screaming that nothing can be solved. Weldon Keyes, Crime Club. Prologue. That summer, I hunted the serial killer at night from my daughter's playroom. For the most part, I mimicked the bedtime routine of a normal person. Teeth brushed, pajamas on. But after my husband and daughter fell asleep, I'd retreat to my makeshift workspace and boot up my laptop, that 15-inch wide hatch of endless possibilities. Our neighborhood northwest of downtown Los Angeles is remarkably quiet at night. Sometimes the only sound was the click as I tapped ever closer down the driveways of men I didn't know using Google Street View. I rarely moved, but I leaped decades with a few keystrokes. Yearbooks, marriage certificates, mugshots. I scoured thousands of pages of 1970s-era police files. I pored over autopsy reports. That I should do this surrounded by a half-dozen stuffed animals and a set of miniature pink bongos didn't strike me as unusual. I'd found my searching place, as private as a rat's maze. Every obsession needs a room of its own. Mine was strewn with coloring paper on which I'd scribbled down California penal codes in crayon. It was around midnight on July 3rd, 2012, when I opened a document I'd compiled listing all the unique items he'd stolen over the years. I'd bolded a little over half the list. Dead ends. The next item to search for was a pair of cufflinks taken in Stockton in September 1977. At that time, the Golden State Killer, as I'd come to call him, hadn't yet graduated to murder. He was a serial rapist, known as the East Area Rapist, who was attacking women and girls in their bedrooms. First in East Sacramento County, then snaking out to communities in the Central Valley and around San Francisco's East Bay. He was young, anywhere from 18 to 30, Caucasian and athletic, capable of eluding capture by vaulting tall fences. A single-story house second from the corner in a quiet middle-class neighborhood was his preferred target. He always wore a mask. Precision and self-preservation were his identifying features. When he zeroed in on a victim, he often entered the home beforehand when no one was there, studying family pictures, learning the layout. He disabled porch lights and unlocked sliding glass doors. He emptied bullets from guns. Unworried homeowners' closed gates were left open. Pictures he moved were put back, chalked up to the disorder of daily life. The victim slept untroubled until the flashlight's blaze forced open their eyes. Blindness disoriented them. Sleepy minds lumbered, then raced. A figure they couldn't see wielded the light. But who? And why? Their fear found direction when they heard the voice, described as a guttural whisper through clenched teeth, abrupt and threatening, though some detected an occasional lapse into a higher pitch, a tremble, a stutter, as if the masked stranger in the dark was hiding not only his face, but also a raw unsteadiness he couldn't always disguise. The Stockton case in September 1977, in which he'd stolen the cufflinks, was his 23rd attack, and came after a perfectly bracketed summer break. Drapery hooks scraping against a curtain rod awakened a 29-year-old woman in her bedroom in northwest Stockton. She rose from her pillow. Outside patio lights framed a silhouette in the doorway. The image vaporized as a flashlight found her face and blinded her. A force of energy rushed toward the bed. His last attack had been Memorial Day weekend. It was 1:30 a.m. on the Tuesday after Labor Day. Summer was over. He was back. He was after couples now. The female victim had tried to explain the foul odor of her attacker to the reporting officer. She struggled to identify the smell. Bad hygiene wouldn't account for it, she said. It didn't come from his underarms or his breath. The best the victim could say, the officer noted in his report, was that it seemed like a nervous scent that emanated not from a particular area on his body, but from his every pore. The officer asked if she could be more specific. She couldn't. The thing was, it wasn't like anything she'd ever smelled before. As in other cases in Stockton, he ranted about needing money, but ignored cash when it was right in front of him. What he wanted was items of personal value from those he violated. Engraved wedding bands, driver's licenses, souvenir coins. The cufflinks, a family heirloom, were in unusual 1950s style and monogrammed with the initials N.R. The reporting officer had made a rough drawing of them in the margin of the police report. I was curious about how unique they were. From an internet search, I learned that boys' names beginning in N were relatively rare, appearing only once in the top 100 names of the 1930s and 40s, when the original owner of the cufflinks was likely born. I Googled a description of the cufflinks and hit the return key on my laptop. It takes hubris to think you can crack a complex serial murder case that a task force representing five California jurisdictions, with input from the FBI, hasn't been able to solve. especially when your detective work is, like mine, DIY. My interest in crime has personal roots. The unsolved murder of a neighbor when I was 14 sparked a fascination with cold cases. The advent of the internet transformed my interest into an active pursuit. Once public records came online and sophisticated search engines were invented, I recognized how a head full of crime details could intersect with an empty search bar. And in 2006, I launched a website called True Crime Diary. When my family goes to sleep, I time travel and reframe stale evidence using 21st century technology. I start clicking, scouring the internet for digital clues authorities may have overlooked, combing digitized phone books, yearbooks, and Google Earth views of crime scenes, a bottomless pit of potential leads for the laptop investigator who now exists in the virtual world. I share my theories with the loyal regulars who read my blog. I've written about hundreds of unsolved crimes, from chloroform murderers to killer priests. The Golden State Killer, though, has consumed me the most. In addition to 50 sexual assaults in Northern California, he was responsible for 10 sadistic murders in Southern California. Here was a case that spanned a decade and ultimately changed DNA law in the state. Neither the Zodiac Killer, who terrorized San Francisco in the late 1960s and early 70s, nor the Night Stalker, who had Southern Californians locking their windows in the 80s, were as active. Yet the Golden State Killer has little recognition. He didn't have a catchy name until I coined one. He attacked in different jurisdictions across California that didn't always share information or communicate well with each other. By the time DNA testing revealed that crimes previously thought to be unrelated were the work of one man, more than a decade had passed since his last known murder, and his capture wasn't a priority. He flew under the radar, at large, and unidentified, but still terrorizing his victims. In 2001, a woman in Sacramento answered her phone in the same house where she'd been attacked 24 years earlier. "Remember when we played?" a man whispered. She recognized the voice immediately. His words echo something he said in Stockton when the couple's 6-year-old daughter got up to use the bathroom and encountered him in the hallway. He was about 20 feet away, a man in a brown ski mask and black knit mittens who was wearing no pants. He had a belt on with some kind of sword in it. "I'm playing tricks with your mom and dad," he said. "Come watch me." The hook for me was that the case seemed solvable. His debris field was both too big and too small. He'd left behind so many victims and abundant clues, but in relatively contained communities, making data mining potential suspects easier. The case dragged me under quickly. Curiosity turned to clawing hunger. I was on the hunt, absorbed by a click fever that connected my propulsive tapping with a dopamine rush. I wasn't alone. I found a group of hardcore seekers who congregated on an online message board and exchanged clues and theories on the case. I set aside any judgments I might have had and followed their chatter, all 20,000 posts and counting. I filtered out creeps with iffy motives and concentrated on the true pursuers. Occasionally, a clue, like the image of a decal from a suspicious vehicle seen near an attack, would appear on the message board. A bit of crowdsourcing by overworked detectives who were still trying to solve the case. I didn't consider him a ghost. My faith was in human error. He made a mistake somewhere along the line, I reasoned. On the summer night I searched for the cufflinks, I'd been obsessed with the case for nearly a year. I favor yellow legal pads, especially the first 10 or so pages when everything looks smooth and hopeful. My daughter's playroom was littered with partially used pads, a wasteful habit and one that reflected my state of mind. Each pad was a thread that started and stalled. For advice, I turned to the retired detectives who'd worked on the case, many of whom I'd come to consider friends. The hubris had been drained from them, but that didn't stop them from encouraging mine. The hunt to find the Golden State Killer, spanning nearly 4 decades, felt less like a relay race than a group of fanatics tethered together climbing an impossible mountain. The old guys had to stop, but they insisted I go on. I lamented to one of them that I felt I was grasping at straws. "My advice? Grasp a straw," he said. Work it to dust. The stolen items were my latest straw. I wasn't in an optimistic mood. My family and I were headed to Santa Monica for 4th of July weekend. I hadn't packed. The weather forecast was lousy. Then I saw it. A single image out of hundreds loading on my laptop screen, the same style of cufflinks as sketched out in the police file, with the same initials. I checked and rechecked the cop's crude drawing against the image on my computer. They were going for $8 at a vintage store in a small town in Oregon. I bought them immediately, paying $40 for overnight delivery. I walked down the hallway to my bedroom. My husband was on his side, sleeping. I sat on the edge of the bed and stared at him until he opened his eyes. I think I found him, I said. My husband didn't have to ask who him was. Part 1 Irvine, 1981. After processing the house, the police said to Drew Whithune, It's yours. The yellow tape came down. The front door closed. The impassive precision of badges at work had helped divert attention from the stain. There was no avoiding it now. His brother and sister-in-law's bedroom was just inside the front door, directly across from the kitchen. Standing at the sink, Drew needed only to turn his head to the left to see the dark spray mottling the white wall above David and Manuela's bed. Drew prided himself on not being squeamish. At the police academy, they were being trained to handle stress and never blench. Emotional steeliness was a graduation requirement. But until the evening of Friday, February 6th, 1981, when his fiancée's sister appeared tableside at the Rathskeller pub in Huntington Beach and said breathlessly, Drew, call your mom. He didn't think he'd be required to use those skills, the ability to keep his mouth shut and eyes forward when everyone else went bug-eyed and screamed. So soon. Or so close to home. David and Manuela lived at 35 Columbus, a single-story tract home in Northwood, a new development in Irvine. The neighborhood was one of the tendrils of suburbia creeping into what was left of the old Irvine Ranch. Orange groves still dominated the outskirts, bordering the encroaching concrete and blacktop with immaculate rows of trees, a packing house, and a camp for pickers. The future of the changing landscape could be gauged in sound. The blast from trucks pouring cement was drowning out the dwindling tractors. An air of genteelness masked Northwood's conveyor belt transformation. Stands of towering eucalyptus, planted by farmers in the 1940s as protection against the punishing Santa Ana winds, weren't torn down but repurposed. Developers used the trees to bisect main thoroughfares and shroud neighborhoods. David and Manuela's subdivision, Shady Hollow, was a tract of 137 houses with four available floor plans. They chose Plan 6014, The Willow, three bedrooms, 1,523 square feet. In late 1979, when the house was finished, they moved in. The house seemed impressively grown up to Drew, even though David and Manuela were only 5 years older than him. For one thing, it was brand new. Kitchen cabinets gleamed from lack of use. The inside of the refrigerator smelled like plastic. And it was spacious. Drew and David had grown up in a house roughly the same size, but seven people had squeezed in there, had impatiently waited their turn for the shower and knocked elbows at the dinner table. David and Manuela stored bicycles in one of their home's three bedrooms. In the other spare bedroom, David kept his guitar. Drew tried to ignore the jealousy prickling him, but the truth was he envied his older brother. David and Manuela, married for 5 years, both had steady jobs. She was a loan officer at California First Bank. He worked in sales at House of Imports, a Mercedes-Benz dealership. Middle-class aspiration welded them. They spent a great deal of time discussing whether or not to get brickwork done in the front yard, and where the best place was to find quality oriental rugs. The house at 35 Columbus was an outline waiting to be filled in. Its blankness conferred promise. Drew felt callow and lacking by comparison. After the initial tour, Drew spent hardly any time at their house. The problem wasn't to the level of rancor exactly, but more like displeasure. Manuela, the only child of German immigrants, was brusque, sometimes puzzlingly so. At California First Bank, she was known for telling people when they needed a haircut or pointing out when they had done something wrong. She kept a private list of co-workers' mistakes that she wrote in German. She was slim and pretty, with prominent cheekbones and breast implants. She'd had the procedure done after her wedding because she was small, and David, she told a co-worker with a kind of distasteful half-shrug, seemed to prefer big chests. She didn't flaunt her new figure. To the contrary, she favored turtlenecks and kept her arms folded in against her body, as if anticipating a fight. Drew could see that the relationship worked for his brother, who could be withdrawn and tentative, and whose manner of speaking was more sideways than straight on. But too often, Drew left their company feeling trodden, the power of Manuela's rotating grievances short-circuiting every room she entered. In early February 1981, Drew heard through the family grapevine that David wasn't feeling well and was in the hospital, but he hadn't seen his brother in a while and didn't make plans to visit him. On Monday, February 2nd, Manuela had taken David to Santa Ana Tustin Community Hospital, where he was admitted for a severe gastrointestinal virus. For the next several nights, she kept the same routine, her parents' house for dinner, then to room 320 at the hospital to see David. They spoke every day and evening by phone. Late Friday morning, David called the bank looking for Manuela, but her co-workers told him she hadn't come in to work. He tried her at home, but the phone kept ringing, which puzzled him. Their answering machine always picked up after the third ring. Manuela didn't know how to operate the machine. Next, he called her mother, Ruth, who agreed to drive over to the house and check on her daughter. After not getting an answer at the front door, she used her key to enter. A few minutes later, Ron Sharp, pseudonym, a close family friend, was summoned in a hysterical call from Ruth. "I just looked over on the left and saw her hands open like that, and saw the blood all over the wall," Sharp told detectives. "I couldn't figure out how it got on the wall from where she was lying." He took one look in the room and never looked again. Manuela was in bed lying face down. She was wearing a brown velour robe and was partially wrapped in a sleeping bag, which she sometimes slept in when she was cold. Red marks circled her wrists and ankles, evidence of ligatures that had been removed. A large screwdriver was lying on the concrete patio 2 feet from the rear sliding glass door. The locking mechanism on the door had been pried open. A 19-inch television from inside the house had been dragged to the southwest corner of the backyard, next to a high wooden fence. The corner of the fence was coming apart slightly, as if someone had fallen against it or jumped it too hard. Investigators observed shoe impressions of a small circle pattern in the front and backyards, and on top of the gas meter on the east side of the house. One of the first peculiarities investigators observed was that the only source of light in the bedroom came from the bathroom. They asked David about it. He was at Manuela's parents' house, where a group of family and friends had congregated after the news to grieve and console one another. Investigators noticed that David seemed shaken and dazed. Grief was making his mind drift. His answers trailed off. He switched subjects abruptly. The question about the light confused him. "Where's the lamp?" he asked. A lamp with a square stand and a chrome metal cannonball-shaped light was missing from atop the stereo speaker on the left side of the bed. Its absence gave police a good idea of the heavy object that was used to bludgeon Manuela to death. David was asked if he knew why the tape was missing from the answering machine. He was stunned. He shook his head. The only possible explanation, he told police, was that whoever killed Manuela had left his voice on the machine. The scene was deeply weird. It was deeply weird for Irvine, which had little crime. It was deeply weird for the Irvine Police Department. It smelled like a setup to a few of them. Some jewelry was missing, and the television had been dragged into the backyard. But what burglar leaves his screwdriver behind? They wondered if the killer was someone Manuela knew. Her husband is staying overnight at the hospital. She invites a male acquaintance over. It gets violent, and he grabs the answering machine tape, knowing his voice is on it, and goes about prying the sliding door, and then, in a final touch of staging, leaves the screwdriver behind. But others doubted that Manuela knew her killer. Police interviewed David at the Irvine Police Department the day after the body was found. He was asked if they had had any problems with prowlers in the past. After thinking about it, he mentioned that 3 or 4 months earlier, in either October or November 1980, there had been footprints that he couldn't explain. They looked to David like tennis shoes and went from one side of the house all the way to the other side and into the backyard. Investigators slid a piece of paper across the table and asked David to draw the footprint as best he remembered it. He sketched it quickly, preoccupied and exhausted. He didn't know that police had a plaster cast impression of Manuela's killer's footprint as he stalked the house the night of the murder. He pushed the paper back. He had drawn a right tennis shoe sole with small circles. David was thanked and allowed to go home. Police slapped his sketch next to the plaster cast impression. It was a match. Most violent criminals are impulsive, disorganized, and easily caught. The vast majority of homicides are committed by people known to the victim, and despite game attempts to throw off the police, these offenders are usually identified and arrested. It's a tiny minority of criminals, maybe 5%, who present the biggest challenge. The ones whose crimes reveal pre-planning and unremorseful rage. Manuela's murder had all the hallmarks of this last type. There were the ligatures and their removal, the ferocity of her head wounds, the several-month lapse between appearances of the soul with small circles, suggesting the slithering of someone rigidly watchful, whose brutality and schedule only he knew. Midday on Saturday, February 7th, having sifted through clues for 24 hours, the police did one more run-through and then authorized release of the house back to David. This was before the existence of professional crime scene cleanup companies. Sooty fingerprint powder stained the doorknobs. David and Manuela's queen mattress was gouged in places where criminalists had cut away sections to bag as evidence. The bed and wall above it were still splattered with blood. Drew knew that, as a cop in training, he was the natural choice for the cleanup job and volunteered to do it. He also felt he owed it to his brother. 10 years earlier, their father, Max Whithune, had locked himself in a room at the family's home after a fight with his wife. Drew was in 8th grade and attending a school dance at the time. David was 18, the oldest in the family, and he was the one who beat down the door after the shotgun blast rocked the house. He shielded the family from the view and absorbed what he saw of his father's splintered brain alone. Their father committed suicide 2 weeks before Christmas. The experience seemed to rob David of certainty. He was suspended in hesitation after that. His mouth smiled occasionally, but his eyes never did. Then he met Manuela. He was on solid ground again. Her bridal veil hung on the back of their bedroom door. The police, thinking it might be a clue, asked David about it. He explained that she always kept it there, a rare sentimental expression. The veil provided a glimpse of Manuela's soft side, a side few had ever known, and now never would. Drew's fiancée was studying to be a nurse practitioner. She offered to help him with the crime scene cleanup. They would go on to have 2 sons and a 28-year marriage that ended in divorce. Even at the lowest points of their relationship, Drew could be stopped short by the memory of her helping him that day. It was an unflinching act of kindness that he never forgot. They hauled out bottles of bleach and buckets of water. They put on yellow rubber gloves. The job was messy, but Drew remained dry-eyed and expressionless. He tried to view the experience as a learning opportunity. Police work called for being coolly diagnostic. You had to be tough, even if you were scrubbing your sister-in-law's blood from a brass bed frame. In a little under 3 hours, they rid the house of violence and tidied it up for David's return. When they were finished, Drew placed the leftover cleaning supplies in his trunk and got behind the wheel of his car. He stuck the key in the ignition, but then froze, seized up, as if on the brink of a sneeze. A strange, uncontainable sensation was winding its way through him. Maybe it was the exhaustion. He wasn't going to cry. That wasn't it. He couldn't remember the last time he cried. Wasn't him. He turned and stared at 35 Columbus. He flashed back to the first time he drove up to the house. He remembered what he'd thought as he sat in his car, preparing to go in. My brother really has it made. The tamped-down sob escaped, the fight to contain it over. Drew pressed his forehead against the steering wheel and wept. Not a lump in the throat cry, but a tumult of brutal grief. Unself-conscious, purging. His car smelled like ammonia. The blood under his fingernails wouldn't come out for days. Finally, he told himself he had to pull it together. He had in his possession a small object he had to give CSI, something he'd found under the bed, something they'd missed. A piece of Manuela's skull. On Saturday night, Irvine PD investigators Ron Veach and Paul Jessup, in search of further information from Manuela's inner circle, rang the front door of her parents' house on Loma Street, in the Greentree neighborhood. Horst Rohrbeck, her father, met them at the door. The day before, shortly after the house was cordoned off and declared a crime scene, Horst and his wife, Ruth, were taken to the station and interviewed separately by junior officers. This was the first time Jessup and Veach, who was the lead detective on the case, were meeting the Rohrbecks. 20 years in the United States hadn't softened Horst's German comportment. He co-owned a local auto repair shop and, it was said, could take apart a Mercedes-Benz with a single wrench. Manuela was the Rohrbecks' only child. She had dinner with them every night. Her personal calendar had only 2 notations for the month of January, reminders about her parents' birthdays. Mama. Papa. Somebody killed her, Horst said in his first police interview. I kill that guy. Horst stood at the front door holding a snifter of brandy. Veach and Jessup stepped inside the house. A half-dozen stricken friends and family were gathered in the living room. When the investigators identified themselves, Horst's stony expression unclenched, and he erupted. He wasn't a big man, but fury doubled his size. He shouted in accented English about how disgusted he was with the police department, how they needed to be doing more. About 4 minutes into the tirade, Veach and Jessup realized that their presence wasn't necessary. Horst was heartbroken and conflict-starved. His rage was a projectile splintering in real time. There was nothing to do but put a business card on the foyer table and get out of his way. Horst's anguish was also tinged with a specific regret. The Rohrbecks were the owners of an enormous, military-grade trained German shepherd named Possum. Horst had suggested that Manuela keep Possum at her house for protection while David was in the hospital, but she declined. It was impossible not to hit rewind and imagine Possum's gaping scissor bite, saliva dripping from his incisors, as he lunged at the intruder, chipping at the lock, scaring him away. Manuela's funeral was Wednesday, February 11th, at Saddleback Chapel in Tustin. Drew spotted officers across the street taking photographs. Afterward, he returned to 35 Columbus with David. The brothers sat talking in the living room late into the night. David was drinking heavily. They think I killed her, David said abruptly about the police. His expression was unreadable. Drew readied himself to hear a confession. He didn't believe David was physically capable of Manuela's murder. The question was whether he could have hired someone to do it. Drew felt his police training kicking in. The image of his brother sitting across from him narrowed to a pinhole. He figured he had one chance. Did you? Drew asked. David's personality, always a bit diffident, had acquired an understandable tremble. Survivor's guilt weighed on him. He'd been born with a hole in his heart. If anyone was going to die, it should have been him. Manuela's parents' grief roved in search of someone to blame. Their gaze had the increasing effect of a glancing blow. But now, in response to Drew's question, David bristled with certainty. No, he said. I didn't kill my wife, Drew. Drew exhaled for what felt like the first time since news of Manuela's murder. He'd needed to hear David say the words. Looking in his brother's eyes, wounded but flashing with assurance, Drew knew he was telling the truth. He wasn't the only one who felt David was innocent. Criminalist Jim White of the Orange County Sheriff's Department helped process the crime scene. Good criminalists are human scanners. They enter messy, unfamiliar rooms, isolate important trace evidence, and block out everything else. They work under pressure. A crime scene is time-sensitive and always on the verge of collapse. Every person who enters represents the possibility for contamination. Criminalists come laden with tools for collection and preservation, paper evidence bags, seals, measuring tape, swabs, bindle paper, plaster of Paris. At the Withune scene, White worked in collaboration with investigator Veitch, who instructed him on what to seize. He collected flaky pieces of mud next to the bed. He swabbed a diluted blood stain on the toilet. He stood with Veitch as Manuela's body was rolled. They noted the massive head injury, ligature marks, and some bruising on her right hand. There was a mark on her left buttock that the coroner would later conclude was likely from a punch. The second part of the criminalist's job comes in the lab, analyzing the evidence that's been collected. White tested the brown paint on the killer's screwdriver against popular brands, concluding that the best match was a store-mixed Oxford brown made by Bayer. The lab is usually where the job ends. Criminalists aren't investigators. They don't conduct interviews or run down leads. But White was in a unique position. The individual police departments of Orange County investigated crimes in their own jurisdictions, but most of them used the sheriff's department's crime lab. Thus, the Withune investigators knew only Irvine cases. But White had worked crime scenes all across the county, from Santa Ana to San Clemente. To Irvine police, Manuela Withune's murder was rare. To Jim White, it was familiar. Dana Point, 1980. Roger Harrington read the handwritten note that was stuck under the doorbell. It was dated 8-20-80, the day before. Patty and Keith, we came by at 7 and no one was home. Call us if plans have changed? It was signed Meredith and Jay, names Roger recognized as friends of his daughter-in-law. He tried the front door and was surprised to find it locked. Keith and Patty rarely locked up when they were home, especially when they were expecting him for dinner. When Roger pulled into the driveway, he'd hit the garage door opener, and there were Keith's and Patty's cars, his MG and her VW. If they weren't inside, they must be out jogging, Roger figured. He reached for a key hidden above the patio trellis and entered the house, taking the mail, which, at a dozen pieces, seemed unusually bulky, inside with him. The house at 33381 Cockleshell Drive is one of roughly 950 in Nigel Shores, a gated community in Dana Point, a beach town in southern Orange County. Roger owned the home, though his main residence was a condo in nearby Lakewood, closer to his office in Long Beach. His 24-year-old son, Keith, a third-year medical student at the University of California, Irvine, and Keith's new wife, Patty, a registered nurse, were living in the house for the time being. A fact that made Roger happy. He liked to have his family close by. The house was decorated in late 70s style. Swordfish on the wall, Tiffany chandelier, ropey plant hangers. Roger mixed himself a drink in the kitchen. Even though it wasn't yet dusk, the house was shadowed and still. The only thing moving was the ocean glinting blue through the south-facing windows and sliding glass doors. An Alpha-Beta grocery bag with two cans of food sat in the kitchen sink. A loaf of sheepherder bread was out, three stale-looking pieces stacked beside it. Roger felt, by degrees, a creeping fear. He walked down the ochre-colored carpeted hallway toward the bedrooms. The door to the guest bedroom, where Keith and Patty slept, was open. Closed shutters made it hard to see. The bed was made, the comforter pulled up to the dark wood headboard. An unusual bump under the bedspread caught Roger's attention as he was about to close the door. He went over and pressed down, feeling something hard. He pulled back the comforter. The contrast between the top of the undisturbed bedspread and what lay underneath was hard to compute. Keith and Patty were lying on their stomachs. Their arms were bent at strange angles, palms up. They seemed, in the strictest sense of the word, broken. Were it not for the ceiling, you might think they'd fallen from a great height. Such was the spread of blood beneath them. Keith was the youngest of Roger's four sons. Excellent student, all-conference shortstop in high school. He'd had one long-term girlfriend before Patty, a fellow undergraduate pre-med student whom everyone assumed he'd marry, until, inexplicably to Roger, she chose another med school to attend and the couple broke up. Keith met Patty shortly after that at UCI Medical Center, and they were married within a year. In the back of his mind, Roger worried that Keith was rebounding and moving too fast. But Patty was warm and clean-cut like Keith. She'd broken up with a previous live-in boyfriend because he used marijuana. And they seemed devoted to each other. Roger had recently been spending a lot of time with the kids, as he referred to them. He'd helped install a new sprinkling system in the yard. The three of them had spent the previous Saturday clearing brush. Later that night, they'd hosted a barbecue for Patty's father's birthday at the house. In the movies, people who discover a dead body shake the corpse disbelievingly. Roger didn't do that. Didn't need to. Even in the dim light, he could see his fair-skinned son was purple. There was no sign of a struggle, no evidence of forced entry, though one of the sliding doors had possibly been left unlocked. Patty bought groceries at 9:48 p.m. on Tuesday night, according to the Alpha Beta receipt. Her sister, Sue, called after that at 11 p.m. Keith answered sleepily and handed the phone to Patty. She told Sue they were in bed. She was expecting an early morning call from the nurse registry. A metal fragment consistent with brass was found in Patty's head wound. That suggested that sometime after Patty hung up with her sister, and before she didn't appear at work Wednesday morning, someone picked up one of the newly installed brass sprinkler heads from the yard and slipped inside the house. In a subdivision with a manned gate. And no one heard a thing. Reviewing the evidence of the Whithune case 6 months later, criminalist Jim White of the Orange County Sheriff's Department felt in his gut that it was connected to the Harrington murders. The cases shared similarities, big and small. They involved middle-class victims bludgeoned to death in bed with objects the killer picked up at the home. In both cases, the killer took the murder weapon with him when he left. In both, the female victims were raped. The bodies of Keith and Patty Harrington showed evidence of ligature marks. Pieces of macrame cord were found in and around their bed. In the Whithune case, 6 months later, ligature marks were also present on the body, but the binding material had been removed from the scene. The difference felt like evidence of learning. The cases also shared an intriguing medical link. Keith Harrington was a med student at UC Irvine, and Patty was a nurse who sometimes worked shifts at Mercy Hospital in Santa Ana. David Whithune, Manuela's husband, had been a patient at Santa Ana Tustin Community Hospital when his wife was murdered. A wooden match with a short burn was found on the Harrington's kitchen floor. None of the Harringtons were smokers. Investigators believe it belonged to the killer. Four wooden matches were collected from the flower bed alongside the Whithune house. Whithune was an Irvine PD case. Harrington was Orange County Sheriff's. Investigators on both teams debated the possible connection. Taking on two people, as the Harrington's killer had, was considered unusual. It was high risk. It suggested the killer's pleasure was in part derived from raising the stakes. Would the same killer, 6 months later, target a single victim as Whithune's had? The counterargument was that David's hospital stay had been a fluke. Was the killer surprised to find Manuela alone that night? Theft, Manuela's jewelry, versus no theft. Forced entry versus no forced entry. They didn't have fingerprints to match. DNA was far in the future. The killer hadn't left an ace of spades at both scenes to identify himself. But small details lingered. When Keith Harrington was fatally struck, the wood headboard above him was dented. Investigators concluded from the location of a wood chip found between Patty's legs that Keith was killed first and then Patty was sexually assaulted. The chronology was planned for her maximum suffering. Manuela's killer spent enough time with her that she was stressed to the point of nausea. Her vomit was found on the bed. Overkill is a popular but sometimes misused term in criminal investigations and crime stories. Even seasoned homicide investigators occasionally misinterpret an offender's behavior when he uses a great deal of force. It's common to assume that a murder involving overkill means there was a relationship between offender and victim, an unleashing of pent-up rage born of familiarity. This was personal, goes the cliche. But that assumption fails to consider external causes of behavior. The level of force may depend on how much a victim resists. Tremendous injuries that look like a personal relationship gone horribly wrong might be the result of a protracted struggle between strangers. Michelle's understanding concerning the use of overkill in these cases had shifted somewhat after this was written. She had since reached the conclusion that only as much force as was necessary to kill was used in the GSK homicides. This information was gleaned from discussions with active investigators, including Paul Holes, who said he was unimpressed by the ferocity of the blows compared to other crime scenes he's analyzed. The messy, dramatic presentation of a bludgeoning death could initially register as overkill, which is likely what happened in some of the GSK cases. Most violent criminals smash through life like human sledgehammers. They have fists for hands and can't plan beyond their sightlines. They're caught easily. They talk too much. They return to the scene of the crime, as conspicuous as tin cans on a bumper. But every so often, a blue moon surfaces. A snow leopard slinks by. Every so often, investigators encounter a stranger murder involving the overkill of victims who didn't resist. Considering that Manuela and Patty were bound, and therefore by definition compliant, the amount of force used to bludgeon them revealed an extreme amount of rage directed at the female. It was unusual to see such frenzied anger combined with calculated planning. A forensic match between the cases didn't exist, but a feeling did. A sense that a single mind was at work, someone who didn't leave many clues or talk or show his face. Someone who strolled undetected in the middle-class swarm, an ordinary man with a resting pulse derangement. The possible connection between Harrington and Whithune was never dismissed outright, just put aside as the cases went cold. In August 1981, several newspaper articles questioned whether or not the Harrington case was related to other recent double homicides in Southern California. "Is a psychopathic night stalker murdering Southern California couples in their beds?" was the opening line of an article in the Los Angeles Times. The Santa Barbara Sheriff's Department had been the first to raise the idea of a connection. They had two double homicides and a knife attack in which the couple escaped. But the other counties with proposed linked cases, Ventura and Orange, downplayed the idea. Ventura officials, still smarting from a highly publicized preliminary hearing where the case against their double homicide suspect fell apart, were quoted as saying they thought Santa Barbara had jumped the gun. Orange County was skeptical, too. "We don't feel that," said investigator Daryl Coder. And that was that. 5 years passed. 10 years. The phone never rang with the right tip. The files, periodically reviewed, never divulged the necessary information. Roger Harrington obsessed over the details, trying to make sense of Keith and Patty's murders. He hired a private investigator. He offered a large reward. Friends and co-workers were re-interviewed. Nothing sparked. In desperation, Roger, a tough, self-made businessman, broke down and consulted a clairvoyant. The psychic couldn't lift the fog. Roger re-examined every moment he spent with Keith and Patty before their deaths. Their murders were a loop of fragmentary details that never cohered and never stopped rotating in his head. Hollywood, 2009. Paparazzi four deep elbowed each other along the red carpet. My husband, Patton, mugged for the cameras in his smart blue pinstriped suit. Flashbulbs deluged. A dozen hands thrust microphones from behind the metal barricade. Adam Sandler appeared. Attention shifted. Clamor ratcheted. Then Judd Apatow, Jonah Hill, Chris Rock. It was Monday, July 20th, 2009, a little after 6 p.m. We were at the Arclight Cinemas in Hollywood for the premiere of the movie Funny People. Somewhere there's probably an unused photograph of a celebrity, and in the background is a woman in a black shift dress and comfortable shoes. I look dazed and exhilarated, and I'm staring at my iPhone, because at that moment, as some of the world's biggest stars brush against me, I've just learned that a fugitive I'd been hunting for and obsessing over, a double murderer on the run in the West and Northwest for the past 37 years, had been found. I dodged behind a concrete column and called the one person I knew would care about the news as much as I did, Pete King, a longtime reporter for the Los Angeles Times who now worked in media relations for the University of California. He picked up right away. "Pete, do you know?" I said. I could barely get the words out fast enough. "Know what?" "I just got an email with a link to a news story. There's been a shootout in some remote mountains in New Mexico. Two people are dead, a sheriff's deputy, and the guy they were after. A kind of mysterious mountain man stealing from cabins." "No," Pete said. "Yes," I said. "They fingerprinted the mountain man." I admit I paused here for maximum dramatic effect. "Joseph Henry Burgess," I said. "Pete, we were right. He was out there all this time." Our stunned silence lasted only a moment. I knew Pete wanted to get to a computer. The premiere organizers were herding people inside. I could see Patton scanning for me. "Find out more," I told Pete. "I can't. I'm at a thing." This thing was not my thing. I realize confiding unease with movie premieres isn't the most relatable hang-up and falls under the exasperated, must-be-nice category. I get it. Bear with me. I'm not being falsely humble when I say that I haven't yet attended a Hollywood event where someone hasn't tucked in a tag, adjusted a button, or told me I had lipstick on my teeth. I once had an events coordinator bat my fingers from my mouth when I was biting my nails. My red carpet pose can best be described as ducked head half crouch. But my husband's an actor. I love him and admire his work and that of our friends, and occasionally attending these events is part of the deal. So you get fancily dressed and sometimes professionally made up. A driver in a town car picks you up, which makes you feel weird and apologetic. An upbeat public relations person you don't know leads you onto a red carpet where you're shouted at to look here and here at 100 strangers with flashbulbs for faces. And then, after those brief moments of manufactured glamour, you find yourself in a regular old creaky movie theater seat, sipping Diet Coke from a sweaty plastic cup and salting your fingers with warm popcorn. Lights dim. Mandated enthusiasm begins. Walking into the after party, Patton was introduced to the directors of Crank, an action movie he loves starring Jason Statham. He began regaling them with his favorite bits from the movie. "I'm Gatham for Statham," he confessed. After we parted ways with the directors, we paused and surveyed the crowd cramming into the ballroom at the Hollywood and Highland Center. Drinks, gourmet mini cheeseburgers, and maybe even Gary Shandling, an idol of Patton's, awaited us. Patton read my mind. "No problem," he said. A friend intercepted us on our way out. "Getting back to baby?" she said with a warm smile. Our daughter, Alice, was 3 months old. "You know how it is," I said. The truth, of course, was much weirder. I was foregoing a fancy Hollywood party to return not to my sleeping infant, but my laptop, to excavate through the night in search of information about a man I'd never met, who'd murdered people I didn't know. Violent men unknown to me have occupied my mind all my adult life, long before 2007, when I first learned of the offender I would eventually dub the Golden State Killer. The part of the brain reserved for sports statistics or dessert recipes or Shakespeare quotes is, for me, a gallery of harrowing aftermaths. A boy's BMX bike, its wheels still spinning, abandoned in a ditch along a country road. A tuft of microscopic green fibers collected from the small of a dead girl's back. To say I'd like to stop dwelling is beside the point. Sure, I'd love to clear the rot. I'm envious, for example, of people obsessed with the Civil War, which brims with details but is contained. In my case, the monsters recede but never vanish. They are long dead and being born as I write. The first one, faceless and never caught, marked me at 14, and I've been turning my back on good times in search of answers ever since. Oak Park. I hear Terry Keating before I see him. He works as a drummer and drum teacher, and his booming voice is probably a result of either hearing loss or a habit of yelling at his students to be heard. "It's Terry!" he shouts. I look up from my phone as I stand waiting for him and see a medium-sized white guy with a flop of brown hair holding a venti Starbucks cup. He's wearing Levi's and a green t-shirt that says Shamrock Football. But he's not talking to me. He's crossing the street toward 143 South Wesley Avenue, the corner brick house in Oak Park, Illinois, where we have agreed to meet. He's calling out to a man in his 50s working on a car in the driveway. The man is tall, lanky, slightly stooped, his once dark hair gone gray.